All right, so thank you very much for inviting me. And so I was basically told by Marty to just, like, you know, bring sort of a whole bunch of slides and just kind of blabber on, and people will interrupt. And so, you know, I obviously encourage that, right? Because this is not the audience, kind of audience I usually give talks to, right? And, you know, it's hard to predict what people don't know and what they don't know, right? So, you know, you just have to tell me what you don't know, right? Right, so. Yeah, I'm primarily going to talk about genome-wide association studies in Arabidopsis, but I'm going to talk about some things about selection, you know, relevant to molecular evolution as well, if I have time. But I just wanted to put this in sort of a general context, right? So the main question that we are interested in is also the genetic basis of adaptation of evolutionary change, which is, you know, tremendously old and very fundamental question in evolutionary biology, right? There's a lot of models, there's lots of this, there's the other, but it's just been, you know, you have all this fantastic diversity, we understand how selection works, but, you know, going the whole way from molecular changes to understanding how, you know, what is the molecular basis of these changes that selection can act on, right? You know, it's just not very well understood, because until recently it's been, you know, still it's extremely difficult to make this connection, and I hope I'll convince you of that today, right? So it's one of those areas where there's been a lot of theory based on almost no data at all, and but that's about to change now, right? And I hope I can give you some idea about how that's going to happen here. So basic premise, and this is something I'm banging into all my students and postdocs, is that they must sort of base their entire everything they think about, you know, they must assume by the time they graduate, you know, you'll be able to basically, you know, sequence everyone in this room, right? I mean, you know, we'll basically have almost perfect information about the genetic code of everyone, right? It'll be possible to go in and sequence a forest, for instance, right? I mean, you should phrase your questions as if you had all these data. Everything else is just a waste of time, right? Because otherwise you'd be eaten alive by technology. And, you know, so one of the interesting things is that basically, if you were given this information, can you actually answer the questions that you think you're interested in, right? I mean, and if you can't, then you should arguably think of something else to do, right? So that's something to you know, keep in the back of your mind. Now, if you're interested in the genetic basis of adaptation, or basically connecting genotype and phenotype, right, which is the first step for this, working on Arabidopsis is about as good as you can get. You have a model plant, tiny genome, distributed throughout the world, adapted to lots of different environments. And one of the most important things is that it's selfing. So most plants are hermaphrodites, right? And most plants that are hermaphrodites have mechanisms that promote outcrossing. So they have, you know, have sex with others, sometimes with themselves as well. But Arabidopsis doesn't have any of these hang-ups. This is something that's characteristic of many weedy plants. So it goes ahead and fertilizes itself liberally, right? And what that means is that you get inbred, basically homozygous lines out in nature. You know, they still have sex. It's not an asexual organism. And they have quite a bit more sex than C. elegans, I think. But what it means is that if you go out and sample a plant that grows in a particular environment and take it back into the lab, that plant, you have that genotype, and you can replicate that in the lab, right? You can grow that same line under different environments in large quantities. I mean, they also have nice, you know, being weeds, they have this nice property that they produce lots of seeds, right? So you take one plant, you can produce thousands of seeds, right? Then you can put them in little test tubes, stick them in the fridge, take them out whenever you want, you know, and test them in different environments. So from the point of view of connecting genotype to phenotype, this is as if you know, someone studied human cancer, right? You have 10,000 identical twins, and you 5,000 of them, you guys smoke and you guys don't smoke, right? And then we see what happens. I mean, so you can actually get rid of much of the nonsense that you have to deal with when you work at an organism like humans, like trying to do all the statistics to get around the fact that you can't actually replicate anything. Okay, and then furthermore, if you're interested in adaptation, there is a sort of old thing about plants stand still to be counted. So this is an advantage over many other model organisms, that you can actually go out and put plants in controlled environments in nature and see how they do, right? If you try to do this on, say, fruit flies, which are otherwise a wonderful organism, it's hard. You know, they're tiny and they fly. It's not great for looking at how, you know, measuring survival and such under field conditions. Okay. So, right. So the thing I'm going to focus on today is genome-wide association studies. And I don't know, do people in general know what that is, genome-wide association? It's, you know, it's sort of been, there are about three papers in every issue of Nature and Science about it, right? But there are three papers of, about plasma physics too, and I don't read all of those, right? So it doesn't, but it's a very big deal in biology. And let me just take you through it very, very quickly then. So here's the basic idea behind genetic mapping is as follows. So then I'm going to give you the version here, but that assumes that you can work on something that have these inbred lines. So you have two parents, you know, those with hairy leaves and those with not hairy leaves. And they have, you know, two copies of each chromosome if they're diploid. And I color these guys red and these guys blue. And we assume that these are inbred, right? So there are no differences between the two copies. You make an F1, which typically has an intermediate phenotype then, sort of intermediate hairiness. And one chromosome, one part of one of each homologous chromosomes came from this parent, the other from this one. And then if you work on a selfer, you can just let these guys self-fertilize then, right, and become homozygous again. So after a large number of generations, you get what's known as recombinant inbred lines. Individuals that are homozygous, so I just show one of the copies of the chromosomes here, right? But the genomes is a mixture of the two parents, right? And then basically the name of the game is to find the correlation between genotype and phenotype. In this case, the guys with not so hairy leaves all happen to share the top blue bit here, which is the bit of the genome they inherited from this parent, right? So that's how genetic mapping works, right? So, you know, this is the basic idea, right? And it works because of crossing over and recombination, scrambling these genomes. Of course, chromosomes don't come in blue and red, right? But, you know, you can use genetic markers to figure out which bit came from where. And as I kind of illustrated before, we're quickly approaching an era where you don't really use genetic markers. You can just sequence all of this, right, and find out which bit corresponds to this parent and that parent, right? And, of course, there's also a bit of statistics of figuring out. You don't actually just kind of look at the phenotype and look at, it looks like it was here, right? But, you know, it's not rocket science. So what I just showed you was an example of linkage mapping. So there, you're looking for these associations between genotype and phenotype in a population with known relationships, either because they're members of a big pedigree if we work in humans, or if we work on experimental organisms, because you cross them, right, to mix the genomes up. Association mapping is sort of, the only difference is you look for the associations in the regular population of what is usually termed unrelated individuals, which is a hideous misnomer because we're, of course, not unrelated. If we were, it wouldn't actually work. So the idea is then that if you want to find out the genetics of blue eyes, right, you just go into this room, sequence everyone, and you say, put all the blue-eyed guys here and all the, you know, the people with brown eyes in one pool, and then see, well, what do all the blue-eyed people have in common or the brown-eyed people have in common, right? And the reason that could work is because we're not unrelated. It's because you might imagine, and this is, of course, an oversimplification, but you might imagine that all blue-eyed people are blue-eyed because they share some kind of knockout in some pathway that turns on a pigment that would normally make eyes brown but now makes them blue. And, you know, so you can identify, you know, they would share the same allele, and you could find this shared allele if you sequenced everyone. If you had genetic markers, you could still find it because you can identify a haplotype that has been inherited along with that mutation for many, many generations. And the reason you want to do this, let me see here. Yeah. So, let's see here. And this is, of course, the basis of really big projects. So I was saying this has been big news in biology, the human HapMap project, right, which is essentially doing this. Here's the one of the bigger ones published to date. You have very large numbers of individuals, right, divided into those that get a particular disease and those that don't get a particular disease. And then you go through the genome and you genotype, say, a million SNP, single nucleotide polymorphism markers through the genome. And then essentially you run a million t-tests or chi-square tests or whatever test you want to do, right? But that's essentially what you're doing. It's not really anything hard at all. And you expect to get something like this, and I'll show some of these for Arabidopsis in a second. So these are the human chromosomes here, right? 1, 2, 3, all the way up to X. And here you have some kind of negative log p values on this axis. And what you're looking for are these spikes that tell you. And so each of these dots would be one of these million SNPs then, right? And you basically, this would be the negative log p value of a test of association between being having the disease or not having the disease, right? And when you see a spike, that tells you that somewhere markers in this region are overrepresented in the or you know in the disease versus the versus the control. And you know the reason for this would then presumably be that there is something in that region that predisposes you to getting that disease. And the reason people like this is if we actually so let's go back to this thing here. A huge problem with this classical genetic linkage mapping is that the information about the position of the gene comes from crossing over, breaking up the chromosomes, right? And sort of narrowing it down to, in this case, we guessed that the hairlessness was sitting on this, or the lack of trichomes, if you want to be technical, is sitting at the top here, right? But the resolution is limited to how many breaks you have, right, if you can shuffle it finely enough. And when you do a cross like this, all those breaks happen essentially, you know, half of them happen when you form the gametes in this F1 cross here, right? And then they become homozygous and crossing over doesn't matter anymore, right? But it's a small number of generations and recombination is a rare event at the DNA sequence level, right? I mean, it's, you know, it's about 10 to the minus 8 probability per base pair, right? So that means that these chunks you end up isolating things to in a moderately sized design like this, you know, will typically be on the order of millions of base pairs. But when you look at this historical phenomenon instead, I mean, if it indeed is the case that all blue-eyed people share are blue-eyed because they share some allele that, you know, might have arisen 200,000 years ago, there's a large number of generations back to that that would have sort of whittled down anything. And, you know, you could imagine that you really down even to just a single nucleotide, which is the only thing all these guys share in common, that's been enough crossing over to break up all associations otherwise, right? So that's a good thing. So higher resolution. Of course, if you work on humans, you know, the design is natural, right? This kind of association mapping works on cases and controls. Well, that's what doctors have, right? Sick people go to the doctor and self-report, right? Then all you need to do is to find a matching set of controls. The alternative when you do human genetics is to dig up their grandparents, sometimes literally, right? To do genetics on them, right? You have to identify pedigrees. This is hugely costly, and you just don't get very big sample sizes. If you work in experimental organisms, you can always do crosses, right? If you work on fruit flies, or if you work on Arabidopsis, you can, of course, always fine map something with the design I just put up, right, with just a cross like that. I mean, if you're willing to raise 100,000 offspring, right, if you have the greenhouse space and so on and the labor to do it, you could do it, but it's still quite expensive. But as I will illustrate later on, I mean, you know, there are also many organisms. Like, people are trying to work on genetics of forest trees now, where, you know, crosses are not terribly practical, right? You know, people are still analyzing an F2 cross in Sweden that was done in 1912, right? It doesn't work very well. Now, so the disadvantage is the results from doing association mapping are much, much harder to interpret, and I'll try to explain why that is. Basically, it's very hard to control error rates. Whereas in a linkage mapping study, you know, it can't fail, right? If you have enough sample size, you have enough power, and you know it's going to do what it's going to do. Okay, so let me see here. Right, so we have been for several years now. I've been involved in trying to make gene-wide association mapping a reality in Arabidopsis. So this has really only been used in humans so far, because as you can imagine, you know, typing all these SNPs has been, you know, quite expensive and so on. It requires a lot of building of genetic resources. And this really started, 6 or 7 years ago, actually it's more like 8 years ago now, in a project together with Marty and Jory Burgles. And we picked out 96 Arabidopsis lines from all over the world, sequenced 1,500 loci across the genome to get some baseline picture of how polymorphism was distributed within and between populations, how much linkage disequilibrium, how much association there was between markers across the genome. And that was taken to the next step about 2 years ago by Detlef Weigel and Joe Ecker, who took 20 of our lines and used Perl gene technology, the same as that was used in the human HapMap project, to completely resequence these guys, right? And completely resequence in the sense of hybridizing DNA to a chip of the reference genome with all possible single base pair differences, right? It's a sort of crude technique, but it gives you can find a lot of polymorphism that way. And now the ball is back in our court, so we have taken 250,000 of these SNPs, and we're genotyping 1,300 lines. And so this kind of coverage, so for comparison, in the human genome, people are doing 1 million SNPs now for association mapping, but that's a genome 30 times the size. So we have actually much, much higher density of SNPs than the human biologists have. And I'm mostly going to talk about these kind of data today. And then, of course, the next step here, which is already underway, which is so obvious, is to sequence all of these lines completely. So, I mean, I should emphasize here, I don't think I made that point, right? A further advantage of using these inbred lines, right, is that this is not good for any of the biotech companies that like to sell sequencing and genotyping, right? But in the human studies, they design these SNP panels then, right? And then the idea is for every association study that's out there, you know, you collect 40,000 people that get a particular, you know, bipolar disorder, right? And then you do an association mapping, and all these guys have to be genotyped. Here, we sort of flip the thing on its head, right? We're collecting a core set of lines, and we're genotyping or sequencing those. Then we're distributing the lines, right? And everyone else then just has to phenotype them, right? Because we're looking at traits that are spread all over the world. So you don't need to redo the sequencing or genotyping. You're genotyping a core set of lines, right? So that's great news in terms that you can do a lot of research for not that much money. Right? So once we're done with all this genotyping, no one else needs to do it, right? And that's also the rationale, of course, for sequencing them completely. Okay, so genome-wide association studies in Arabidopsis thaliana. So we have done about 300 lines SNP typing now, and to basically get an idea of whether this works, from various sources, we have collected about 186 different phenotypes, which are sort of correlated with each other, and that have been measured in either our set of original set of 96 lines, or in 192 or 384, depending on. And we've been using four different statistical methods. So that, so what I'm going to talk about mostly today, and this is stuff that we only begin to wade through, and I hope I can give you an idea of how complicated it is. So basically, we have 200 million association scores then, right? So 250,000 SNPs by four methods, by 200 different phenotypes, and trying to make sense of all this. So I'll emphasize, we have pretty much only used the simplest possible thing. So I'm going to describe, like, basically analyzing marker by marker association, genotype by phenotype. We're completely ignoring the fact that the phenotypes are correlated. We're ignoring, except for one method, we're ignoring the fact that the SNPs are genotype are correlated with each other, right? I mean, there are all kinds of things one can imagine doing here that we just have not had the time to do, because it turns out that it's hard enough to make sense of it, even in the dumbest possible way.
Is it all done in the lab?
Which part?
All the plants are growing in.
So different labs have collected the phenotypes, right? So the kind of phenotypes we're looking at here is, like, so in my lab, yeah, it's right. There's some field-collected phenotypes too, if that's what you're referring.
About ascertainment bias or the fact that real selection doesn't happen.
So we're not measuring selection, right? We're measuring phenotypes. So for instance, we would take all these lines, right? Grow them in replicate at 10 degrees with long days and see how long they take to flower. Then we grow them at 16 degrees and see how long they take to flower. Someone else will expose them to a particular pathogen and see whether they are sensitive or not sensitive to that pathogen. Someone else will take these plants, grind them up, throw them through a mass spec, and measure concentrations of, 60 different ion levels, right, to look at nutrient levels. So we have all kinds of phenotypes like this. Someone will sit and count trichomes on leaves, So these are so it's a whole bunch of different things. Some of them are strongly correlated with each other, and some of them are not.
You really have to appreciate the ability to measure these traits in replicated plants.
Right. Yeah, so that's the beauty, right? I mean, this is like what I was saying about, cancer, having 5,000 inbred twins, right? When we measure these phenotypes, right? I mean, we basically, from my side, we just measure enough individuals that we can just work with the means, and we throw away the variance between, basically the whole genotype-phenotype variance, right? We just ignore that because we have enough sample size.
So is it true for these 186 phenotypes that the variance that you see within the same strain is small compared to between strains?
So that depends a lot on the phenotype, right? Some phenotypes are much noisier than others. Something like flowering time is usually a very, you know, it's strongly sort of canalized phenotype. They know when to flower and they do it. Pathogen resistance is pretty good as well. Some of the other things we looked at are noisier, like you know, some of these iron levels are, you know, there's some measurement error in there to be sure.
And so, and this fact is sort of then ignored for the further analysis.
Yeah. In what we do here, you know, we've tried to plug it in, right? But mostly we've been working on things where the heritability is extremely high, right? And as you see in a second, you know, we find enough things that way. I mean, you know, not incorporating that can only lead to false negatives, right? You basically introduce noise and you don't find what you're supposed to find. So if you didn't find anything, you'd be wrong to conclude that nothing was there, right? You didn't have the power, right? But we do find things, even though it could be that we found more if we actually modeled the variants appropriately, right?
Well, then there's another consideration as well, like in measuring these phenotypes, I guess. And that is, you don't always know what the best environmental condition is to actually measure the phenotype.
That's right.
For flowering time, well, there could be, there's still light intensity or wavelength differences, or if you're trying to measure drought resistance, something like that, it may actually make it much stronger differences between lines if you also stress them for some nutrients. And with these kind of replicated lines, you can you know, explore that.
Yeah.
I mean, is there, if I say that the definition of your map is going to depend on the number of lines rather than the number of SNPs? Because it seems to me that maybe I'm completely wrong, but the number of SNPs you have is very high compared to the number of lines.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Yes.
I mean, you could increase the data by a lot by increasing the number of lines. And another way of saying things, I mean, it seems to me that you have too many SNPs compared to the number of lines you have.
No, yes and no. Okay, so first of all, this is a problem in all these association studies, all these genome-wide studies. You know, we always have the problem that you have sort of massively more SNPs, right, than you can possibly, you know, the sample size is, I mean, you know, if you were to apply Bonferroni correction or something like that, which we actually do since we have strong things here, but like in the human studies, right, you just don't have the power in that sense, right? But it's not like in the regular linkage mapping designs when there's sort of a trade-off between the sample size. I mean, here it really is the case. You need all these SNPs because the resolution is actually down to the single gene. So you need these many SNPs. It would,
as long as we have enough crossing offers.
Yeah, we do. So because this is association mapping, right? So the crossing, the number of crosses you see does not depend on the sample size.
Okay, yes.
This is historical recombination, right? So basically, you know, the amounts of new recombination events you see is basically going to increase logarithmically with the sample size. That's already there, right? So you need this kind of SNP resolution. You're obviously right that your power is going to go up in a sort of standard way, and more is always better, right? The problem is here that, you know, actually growing and phenotyping a replicate, you know, tens and thousands of plants is something very few, at least very few academic institutions can do because they just don't have the growth chambers and stuff like that to do it. You know, plant breeding companies are in a slightly different position here, but let me, you know, I just wanted to, in some sense, the answer to many of these questions is that it actually does work, right? So it's in the sense that, you know, we do find things, that, you know, it's clear that we would find more if you have bigger sample sizes, if you do all these things, but that's actually in some level not our problem. I'll explain what I mean by that in a second. So I'm irritating on purpose here and don't explain what these things are on the axis here. Of course, I intend to explain what they are, right? So basically, these are the five chromosomes of Arabidopsis in different colors. And here is a negative log p-value again. And this, never mind what the exact method is here. Here is a 5% Bonferroni correction cutoff. And these phenotypes in this case are three different disease-resistant phenotypes, where you basically, this is one of these gene-for-gene interaction things where you basically expose the plant to a particular bacterial elicitor, and it either has a, you know, reacts to that or not. Does it recognize that bug or not, right? And then it sort of typically kills the cells and so on, right? So this is very, quite simple phenotypes. And this is only for 96 individuals. And what you're supposed to see here is, as you go across the genome here, it's like bang. This is 10 to the minus 15, right? And this is a sample of 96 individuals, right? Here, 10 to the minus 12. And you go along here, and that's not such a good choice of color here. But, you know, there's another big peak over here, right? So this is really cool, right? So, you know, you should just, I mean, this is worth emphasizing because the human studies typically involve sort of enormous amounts of resources. There was one published like 6 months ago where they were looking at height in the UK, 40,000 individuals, and they do find significant effects, but they usually explain very little of the variation. This is a completely turned around world here. We have a tiny, I mean, human geneticists would laugh at the sample size of 96, right? But because we have very controlled measurements of the phenotype, and because, I think actually more importantly, because we work on interesting phenotypes, they work on boring things like disease, right? You know, which in a sense is boring, right? Because basically it's all under stabilizing selection, and basically it's all caused by rare mutations, right? There isn't anything major that affects health, whereas with the traits we're working on, there are major determinants in the population of these phenotypes. We can find something, right? So one of my sort of not so hidden aspirations is that with 96 individuals, find more genes than the entire human genetic community has done with, like, you know, 10 to the 2 more resources and enormous sample sizes. So here's
like phenotypes? These are three different phenotypes.
Three different phenotypes, yes.
How much of the variance is explained by these?
Oh, these are almost Mendelian. I mean, this almost explains all the variation. So this is a binary trait. You either react or you don't react. You know, there are some other things going on here that influence instances as well. But, you know, these are also known genes, right? These are genes were known before. And, you know, it's like we just put them in as a control. You know, you can find these things, right?
What fraction of phenotypes produces nice signal?
So that, you know, I don't think I can give you a meaningful answer in terms of, because that rather depends on, you know, your measurements. Stays, right? It works for things like pathogen resistance. It seems to work really well. But I think I'll answer that question. It doesn't work this way all the time, right? That's part of the measure.
This is a test case where those were known basically a Mendelian factor that determines essentially the whole trait.
Exactly.
And you can find them this way.
You can tell that in 100% of the case, you have one phenotype. You have this allele assigned?
No, it's not perfect correlation, no. It doesn't explain all the variation, but almost all the variation.
So is it fair to say in a sense that these 96 Arabidopsis lines show much bigger phenotypic variation than, let's say, human populations? And this might be one of the reasons why it's easier to find things that really show a high variance.
Well, yes and no. I mean, so I'll get into that in a second. Yes and no. I mean, okay, so let me I'm just going to get to the point later. Part of the problem, I mean, so for disease, right, you know, there's always sort of minority phenotype. But even the study of height, for instance, was all carried out within the UK. I mean, I was sitting at a meeting with a bunch of, where we talked about complex traits and so on. There was a bunch of other, you know, plant people there, and we were all, you know, this is ridiculous, right? I mean, plant breeding, I mean, you know, what you do if you want to work on interesting genes for height in humans, you cross the Maasai with a pygmy, right? You know, I mean, you're basically willfully excluding the interesting variation. There's clearly a lot of, if you look globally, there's a lot of variation in humans for a lot of traits, right? There are clearly some traits, like, you know, skin color, for instance, is one where there's obviously are major alleles that explain a lot of the variation in a global sense, right? But I'll get to that in a second. Let me just so here's the, one of these slides I showed before. So here's a very simple disease resistance phenotype. Here is a fungal pathogen. And it's suddenly much more complicated. You see, I don't know if you can read these numbers, but this little dotted line here is that Bonferroni line here, which is at the top of the plot here, and it's at the bottom here, right? And here, there's something that kind of ekes up to being significant there. So this is a much more complicated trait. There isn't like a gene-for-gene interaction to this particular fungal pathogen. It's more complicated. So here, but here I think it's just one of those cases. If you had a bigger sample size, you'd nail it, right? You just need a bigger, you know, because it's complicated, it's multifactorial, we don't have the power to detect it. That turns out, so that's a kind of a boring problem, right? You just need to add more money.
Is this a fungal pathogen that the plant is expected to have encountered in the
plant? Yeah, yeah. Yes.
So then aren't you worried that there is no obvious genotype that deals with it?
No, because I didn't, you know, if you, it's not, you know, if there's a lot of, unless there are really major alleles around. I mean, you know, you only have a sample of 96, right? And you try to do a correlation. There's just not. I mean, look. I mean, there is something here, right? It's just up to 10 to the minus
so
6.5.
The point that sample size is not important. I'm not trying to.
Sample size? No. Sorry. Sample size is not important for the recombination bit. Sample size is certainly important for the correlation between genotype and phenotype, right? Because that it's just a simple correlation exercise, right? And you know, and you, if it is the case that the phenotype is caused by many small things. I mean, this essentially. I mean, okay. You know, this is the problem with the human studies, right? I don't know if you heard about the common disease, common variant hypothesis, right, which is basically used as a sales pitch for the human product. I mean, the idea would be that there are common variants in the human population that explain common diseases like asthma and so on. The alternative scenario, which is rather more grim from the point of view of actually doing human genetics, is that asthma and stuff like that are caused by an extremely unlucky draw that, you know, there's a long, long tail, hundreds of genes of minute effect that, you know, push you over the edge, right? If you cross the edge, or it could also be the case, which is also very bad, and appears to be the case for some of these diseases like schizophrenia, autism, and so on, that indeed there are major genes, but all of them are exceedingly rare. They're like, in fact, de novo mutations that happened like three generations ago, right? So there's something in a particular family that segregates that has a big effect on that family's predisposition for getting a particular disease, but you don't find that allele anywhere else. Which, of course, that you know, you can find that maybe in that family if it happens to be a Mormon family, so it has like 1,500 offspring. Otherwise, you can't find it. But you know, once if you find it, it still helps you explain nothing about what's going on in the population at large. But that's because that's why these guys got ill, right? That doesn't tell you why everyone else got ill. So right. So it's the power here depends both on the individual effect of the alleles and how frequent they are in the population. Are there sort of major determinants?
Wait a minute, Professor. Just to follow that point further. If the pathogen was encountered a lot of times in the past,
yep.
Would you expect that there would be a Mendelian-like response to it because of strong selection in the past?
Maybe I would. In that case, I'd be wrong. I don't know. I mean, this is an empirical question, right?
You're pushing your argument
yep.
To escape logical conclusion.
No, I don't think so. I mean, it depends on the details of how the interactions between the pathogen, you know, work. There are all kinds of, you know, there can be arms races. It depends on how spatially distributed it is. It depends on the rates of
The reason I'm asking is asthma won't kill you.
That's right.
But not being able to resist the fungal pathogen will kill you.
Maybe. Sometimes. It can depend on how moist it is. Some years it's not moist enough for that pathogen to grow and you're okay. There was a recent field trial. I talked to people who have been involved, you know, growing lots of Arabidopsis accessions everywhere. And they were looking for resistance factors to fungal pathogens, among other things, right? But the field trials in Germany all worked beautifully. The ones in England, on the second year, everyone died because it was so bloody rainy and wet that, you know, fungal pathogens wiped out the entire population regardless of genotype, right? So, you know, it's complicated, right? I mean, you know, I don't have a clear prediction, right, for this thing. But let me get to, you know, the thing that's actually a much harder problem for us. So here's, again, another complicated. So here's a beautiful example again, right, which is cheating because it's a simple gene. Here's what we find for one of the flowering phenotypes. So now here's the Bonferroni correction line again. And you'll here we have this nice peak, right? And here, oops, there's a good fraction of the genome that is involved here, right, associated with the phenotype. You see spikes everywhere. And, you know, and the, again, right, this is a Bonferroni correction. I mean, you have p-values here, 10 to the minus 11, 10 to the minus 12. This is not noise. I mean, these are significant, right? You know, we don't even look at stuff that where we have to worry about standard statistical noise. What's going on here is another well-known problem, confounding by population structure. So if you took the p-values from that last plot and plotted the p-value distribution here, right, it looks sort of like this. So massively skewed towards significance. If you look at the cumulative distribution instead, here's the red line, right, and here's what you'd expect, right. So this is sort of like a QQ plot, right. So you would expect 20% under the null hypothesis that nothing is going on, right, that there's no associations. 20% of all tests should be significant at the 20% level or so on, right. The p-value distribution should be uniform, right. And it's not. Instead, what you find is that at the 20% level, 40% is significant. And of course, when you get down to here, things that are really significant, the effect is astonishing. And as you can kind of guess here, it's actually, it looks like if you arbitrarily, in this case, if you do a square root transform with the p-values, you get a uniform, right? So basically, you know, the probability of seeing a p-value of 10 to the minus 12 empirically is actually 10 to the minus 6, right? And, you know, So, right, so there's extreme bias towards seeing highly significant results.
What kind of population distribution
do you assume? So, I don't assume anything. I assume no population. This is all, I assume there is no population structure here, right?
So this square root, are we supposed to understand that remark instead of, you know, like, raising it to the power 0.4 or 0.6?
I don't think there's any magical value, but it just gives you an idea of what the magnitude is, right? So basically, if you expect that one in 1,000 of all your tests should just by chance alone give you a p-value less than 10 to the minus 3, right? In fact, one in a million will give you 10 to the minus 6. You know, in fact, one in 1,000 gives you that kind of p-value. So we see lots of significances down at that level.
You're making an empirical observation that if you were to take the square root, the
correct
p-value would get roughly a straight
line. Yep. Okay. Yeah. So it just gives you. If you're looking for something deep to prove here, I think there is something weird about the fact that you can actually find a transformation that gives this sort of a straight line like this. It doesn't seem obvious that this should just be like some kind of exponential transformation that gives you back to a straight line, but I haven't thought very, but there's empirically nothing magical about the number 0.5 or whatever. Okay, right, so what's going on here, right? So what's going on here is essentially what I just said about, if you took the pygmies and the mass size. I mean, so the reason you'd measure height in England only, right, is in some sense you have a homogeneous population. If you took, well, actually take skin color instead, it's a better example. You know, if you were interested in skin color differences and you took 10,000 humans, right, and 5,000 of them were Swedes and 5,000 of them were Nigerians, and now you try to map skin color, right, so then you have a lot of variation. The problem there is that if you made tests across the genome, there's a whole lot of markers that are just associated frequency differences between these populations, right? It's just completely spurious correlations that have an elevated p-value because of this. And that's, of course, what we're seeing here, right? Because we are effectively doing something like that. We're looking at a trait like flowering time, which is usually an adaptation to climate. We have individuals collected throughout the world, and then we do an association test. So, right, so that's like looking at skin color. It's something that's correlated with geography, and if you did that, you know, you'd have a lot of spurious associations in humans as well.
In some sense, you don't really know this as a fact.
Nope.
That it is the population structure.
Well, you know that there is population.
There's some other ones where you have the exact same population structure, but you're happy to make believe that.
That's right. So I mean, what's going on here, right? I think there's several things going on. I mean, you know, part of it is that here is the phenotype is correlated with, you have a phenotype that is clearly spatially correlated with the spatial structure as well, right? So really, I mean, so there's like an underlying hidden variable here, right, which is the population structure. It explains both the SNP frequencies across the genome and it's correlated with the phenotype.
Why can't you, within the data set, and the standard methods to remove population structure?
Uh-huh. So I'm getting to that. So you can do that. There are several things that have been proposed, and I'm not going to really go into these in detail because it would take way too long. I mean, but they basically, so here's a method that kind of essentially looks at the inflation of, say, a chi-square statistic and, divides by a constant and get you back to a straight line for that. Here's another one where you basically try to infer what the population structure is and then try to use that as a covariate in the analysis. You can do the same thing using principal components, right? You can basically try to, infer something using all your SNPs about what the underlying population structure is and then sort of, in some sense, regress that out of what's going on. There is a mixed model approach, which I would just put up. It's the only approach that has worked for us, that basically, rather than trying to infer the population structure, looks at, basically assumes that there's a random deviation from the population mean for each individual, right? And the covariance between individuals in these random deviates is controlled by the amount of allele sharing essentially across the genome. How related is this pair of individuals, right? So you look at genetic relatedness across the genome and you look at phenotypic covariance between individuals, right? And you basically sort of estimate, so you put that in as a sort of a variance term and sort of, let this sort of random effect soak up. How much of the phenotypic covariance can you explain by genetic genome-wide similarity, right? And that kind of works, right? And then, yeah, well, I guess maybe I should say, so these other methods don't work in our case. So again, this is something, there's a bit of a, if you talk to people who work in humans, they will sort of tell you, oh, the problem is solved, right? There are established methods of doing this. Well, all the methods that work in human genetics do not work in our case. And the reason for that is simply that our population structure is much more complicated than the ones that is typically used in human genetics, right? It's one thing to say that you have, I mean, if you have a sample of, say, you know, Nigerians and Swedes, right? It's, you know, simple principal component analysis would like instantly pick up, you know, there's basically two effectively random mating populations that are separated from each other. In our sample, it's more like isolation by distance, right? I mean, the amount of how closely related two individuals are depends on how closely, you know, sampled they were. And presumably, you know, you would find something the same way in humans if someone actually got around to doing, you know, basically you walked across the equator and sampled individuals like the cheek swabs at every, you know, kilometer or so, right? You'd get something similar in humans, right? Because there's isolation by distance in humans as well. But that's typically not how these studies are made, right? That's why this kinship works better. But okay, now I'm losing the thread here. So now, so corrective population structure works in the sense that, so here's that figure I showed you before. You have all these inflated p-values all over the place. And now if you apply this mixed model correction, you get something that, you know, has a, you know, sensible looking p-value distribution. There's a few values that are significant. And you can see here that, you know, a lot of these highly significant peaks here kind of just disappear. So here is one here, for instance, that just goes away when you correct the population structure. So these would be associations that are very strongly corrected with the population structure. You can sort of get that out of things, right?
So to say that because the p-value distribution looks a bit more like something you like now,
yep.
It works.
Yep.
That's maybe a bit optimistic.
Yes, though. I agree. That is a bit optimistic. So the only thing you can say here is that in a couple of control cases, it works. There's in the few simulations and stuff like that have been done, it works. There is a sensible theoretical basis for where these things should work. But yes, I agree with you. It's not clear. I'll get to that in a second. I actually, you know, when I say that it works, you know, you notice little dots up there. I actually don't think it works, but there's actually a much more serious problem than the one you allude to.
You could test it experimentally by just doing linkage association.
Sure, you can. So and all these things are in the works. Absolutely, right? I mean, that's kind of, you're sort of anticipating the main point here, right? Basically, that, you know, these kind of methods are not a magic bullet for doing this, right? So basically, no, well, I'll get to it in a second. So, you know, no model is perfect, right? I mean, that's all. You still won't completely be able to trust your p-values, right? Because, you know, you can't get it completely right. So you will have some false positives, right?
Another question.
Yeah.
So, okay, in all of this approach, you are assuming that there is an underlying population structure, and certainly there is one.
Yes.
But there could also be, well, maybe not in this case, a structure in the correlation of the gene, of the different site in a sense. So for instance, if you take all the spikes on the left part, you could say all SNPs between 0 and 10 in the x-axis are really, really very, very correlated.
Mm-hmm.
So that whenever one spikes above the Bertaroni threshold, all the block of the SNPs correlated would spike over this threshold.
Yeah.
How could you disentangle? I understand that this is not the case here.
Well, partly it is the case, right? Because, I mean, there are two ways to answer. So partly you're absolutely right, but partly that is population structure, right? I mean, what population structure does is cause, linkage disequilibrium, right? I mean, that's sort of, you know, in some, you can probably define it that way if you want to, right? You get correlations between SNPs because, I mean, if you took the Nigerian Swedish example, I mean, you have, just like, you know, the reason you get false positives is that you have statistical associations between SNPs that are sort of unlinked effectively, right? Now, why do you see these things in particular regions here, right? So you could imagine that somehow there's like suppression or recombination. That turns out that is not the case. And I'll show you some figures, but there's still something weird going on because you are absolutely right in that these things are clustered, and I don't know why that is yet. I'll get to that in a second.
Isn't there a simple way to get rid of this? Is to use two outbred sets of plants and then see if you get the same SNPs in both of them?
Yeah, so the problem with that, right, is, you know, so then you're back to the linkage mapping scenario, which, so yeah, linkage mapping has the advantage that it's completely immune to to this confounding. I mean, that's what I was saying, you know, that the association results are hard to interpret because it's hard to get control for the false positives and false negatives. The problem, of course, when you make these crosses is that then you're down to this problem that you're looking at regions that are, you know, I don't actually think I have a slide of that here, but, you know, a typical sort of QTL map, linkage mapping result, would sort of tell you that there is something in this region here, right? You know, which would be hundreds of genes, right? And that doesn't, you know, so, but obviously some combination of experimental results like this and these results is what's going to be required. Yeah.
So but having done the correction, do you have some idea what the population structure there actually is? Is it
it's mostly
blocks?
It's isolation by distance, by and large. You know, you explain most of what's going on is basically, you know, the further things are, the more distantly related they are, and that explains most of it.
There could be a lot more in that data because, ultimately you want to sort this thing by haplotypes, and this sort of extreme view of population structure mm-hmm. is that, you know, there are these two sets of haplotypes mm-hmm. which are completely unmixed. Which, going back to your initial slide, just mm-hmm. means that there hasn't been any recombination between
sure.
those two particular things.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have this geographic continuity, as mm-hmm. you're describing, you may have still significant, although perhaps local, mixing between...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Otherwise, that's right. Absolutely, and one needs to have... So I'm going to get to that too, I think. I mean, yeah, you need to... It really depends on how you sample. I mean, you can, you know, so getting more local samples will certainly help. You know, the problem is, you know, there is signal in the data, right? I mean, like you said, in the extreme case, if you just had two isolated things, right?
So to follow on Boris's question, mm-hmm. you're looking at single SNPs association with... But there are standard algorithms to build patterns of SNPs, mm-hmm. essentially, not even haplotypes. You don't need haplotypes.
Sure.
Just sets of combinations of SNPs. That, and these are exhaustive methods which mm-hmm. maybe will identify the haplotype that seems to be selected for across all the chromosomes. I don't know if you've applied any of this. But
I've done some haplotype-based things, but not necessarily.
But they're not haplotype-based. They're just, right. If you give me the set of SNPs and you give me the set of,
right.
of phenotypes, I can tell you which sets of SNPs are strongly correlated, not just
sure.
single.
So let me hold that thought, because actually I want to post you know, since there are many people who like to think about data here, there are some really hard problems to think about, and I'll get to that in a second, right? I just wanted to explain, you know, why you know, so we mentioned the fact that you have a problem with the confounding that you know, you can never be completely sure of the p-values anyway, right? But there's a much worse one, which is the fact that if you remove confounding, I mean, if your algorithm for doing that does its job, effectively it's going to throw out the baby with the bathwater in many cases, right? Because, right? And you know, and I, you know, here's a kind of example of this. Like, so here was like a paper that came out in Nature Genetics 2 years ago, right? Mapping a skin color, hair color, etc. differences, eye color in Iceland. Okay, so interesting as that may be, you know, you'll realize that, you know, if you do mapping within Iceland, you throw out a lot of important human variation, right? And, you know,
and
yes, I have the same sampling bias as the Nature editor, so that I ignore, you know, some aspects of variation, such as not everyone is female and not everyone is beautiful, but you know, sort of within the set of people that are beautiful and female, right, you'll still recognize that there is, right? I mean, effectively, if you correct the population structure, if you took a sample of people that look like her, people that looked at her, and the people that looked like these women, right, and you corrected for population structure, you might be able to map these differences, right? But you'd effectively you'd risk throwing out what you're actually looking for, the really big important things, right? Because, you know, interesting as this is, right, it's a small fraction of human variation.
And as you say, I mean, some aspects of those humans in color, may be adaptive, but perhaps many of them are not.
Yeah.
But for the evolutionary geneticist, was actually interested in, you know, the genetic basis of adaptive variation.
Mm-hmm.
Then you really have a problem.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where you probably expect to throw up maybe.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Right. So right, I mean, so this is so clearly you need some substitute. I mean, you know, you need to make some crosses, you need to make transgenics, you need to get other data, right? Because even though to some extent, right, I mean, in the human case, you know, of course, skin colors actually do gradate. Right? So if you had a better sample than the one I could have threw up there, you might be able to disentangle this to some effect, right? But you can't, you know, probably completely do it, right? So essentially, then what we are down to with the Arabidopsis is, and you have to recognize this, we're generating lists of interesting associations, right? When the p-values have meanings, as we, you know, might or may not believe that they do, when you have a method that generates a sensible p-value distribution, right? You can sort of use some kind of cutoffs and see what you believe in. For the other ones, well, what do we do? Well, you kind of start from the top, right? And there is a signal. So here is a not
so
mass.
Confounding effect that typically does it sort of conserve the ranks of the p-values, or does it just tank, compute them all over the place?
It doesn't. They're somewhere in between, as you'd expect, right? It definitely, yeah. And you know, you can try to quantitate that. I mean, maybe this will give you. No, this will not give you an answer to that one. Right. The ranks do change, right? But obviously they correlate. That if you like step back and take a big picture, there is some correlation, right? But it's rough, very rough. So I mean, this is just a slide. I just wanted to. I mean, so you know, so we have 200 million of these tests, right? And we have convinced ourselves that we can apply corrections to population structure and pick out things that are significant by also standard criteria. And of course, we're going to pay attention to those that remain after that. But we also know a priori that if you do that, you're going to throw out some of the most interesting things. So then we're faced with a whole bunch of associations where p-values have no meaning because they're clearly confounded, right? So how do we know it's not all garbage? And you can answer that in two ways. One is, well, look, the genes have to be somewhere. There is a genetic basis for this, right? And we actually have genome-wide coverage, so we have enough power. You know, some of these peaks actually have to be the ones where the differences are. But, you know, but this, if that doesn't satisfy you, here's another thing we did for these flowering time. Ooh, sorry, I switched the colors here. These should be swapped. You can define an a priori list of things that you believe are important for flowering time. And then you look at the distribution of ranks of associations for SNPs that are correlated among that set and the sort of control. And what you see then, there's a clear tendency here. I mean, if you look at, you know, it kind of up here, right, then it kind of goes down. So this is ranked. This is high ranking, sort of highly significant ones up here, right? So there's a clear tendency for SNPs that are situated, contrary to this legend, close to an a priori candidate chosen before looking at any of the data, to be strongly associated. So there is a signal, right? You know, that this would not happen. That tells you that our candidate list, first of all, molecular biologists are not worthless. You know, these a priori candidates actually are involved with flowering time, and there is a signal in our data, right? Otherwise, you could not get this. And we've been working on methods to try to estimate false discovery rates from these kind of data, right? You have to make a bunch of assumptions. Let me just show you a couple of other pictures here. So here's a nice example of the kind of things we find. So here are three different methods. So here's flowering time on the long days at 18 degrees. Let's see here, what do we have here? So the red dots is just a simple Kruskal-Wallis test, so a non-parametric sort of rank-based test of association between genotype and phenotype. And here are some red dots here. And right, the light blue dots here is using random forests. It's basically one of these attempts to kind of pick out what's important. So kind of perhaps along the lines of what you were saying. Picking out SNPs that sort of explain the phenotype, right? Here, the blue dot here is a peak that you get for after correcting for population structure. So this is a mixed model correction. And the green line here is one of these algorithms that tries to estimate local coalescence, essentially local trees, right, with all the breaks divide that tree, put the mutation on different branches, right? And we hacked that up to apply a Kruskal-Wallis test to do the test of association. But effectively, you see that this green line followed the red lines pretty well. But it sort of smooths it out, right? Because it tells you that even though here is our SNP and here is our next SNP, which is not associated, you know, in fact, that could, you know, the association could be sort of anywhere in between here. And this is a nice example, and I say that because, you know, so basically here there's a bunch of methods that tell you that something is important here. And this gene turns out to be a gene that we know is a very strong candidate being involved in flowering time. There's at least one linkage mapping study that has identified this as actually harboring a natural variation. So this is beautiful. But of course, even here, you know, there's something going on here. I don't know what that is. And it gets much worse than that. Well, actually, let me show you. Here's what it looks like. 18 degrees plus the cold treatment, right? So the change, the relative orders of the SNPs changed a little bit, but there's still an association here.
So can I ask you, is the linkage map within your sample set probably not reflective of the true linkage map in the wild, right? So these SNPs that are next to the one that is identified,
yep,
are they in linkage disequilibrium with your with that SNP or not in your plants?
Yes, they're in linkage disequilibrium,
but
for
in
sure.
In real, they may not be. I mean, is your sample just a subset of the true diversity?
Are you talking? Let me see. Are you talking about like the genome being rearranged between different lines, or no?
Well, you have inbred strains, right? Highly inbred.
Yeah, but they're naturally inbred strains. This plant is naturally inbred.
But haven't you processed it?
No.
Many generations?
No. No, they're taken from nature. I mean, there is ascertainment against throwing out the ones that recently had outcrossed in nature, but otherwise, no. And you know, and the linkage equilibrium things reflect much deeper timescales than these couple of generations, anyway. I just want to get, so here. I mean, so here's one of the things. So like, if you look at short days, this peak goes away, and if you actually look at the sort of molecular biology of this particular gene here, it's actually expected to have a phenotype on the long days, not on the short days. So all everything fits. So this is beautiful. Here's like an example, right? And I just wanted to, you know, so here we basically find the gene, you know, straight off the bat, right? And just to give you a sense of that, I mean, that this is typically 2 years of full-time work for some postdoc in molecular biology to do this kind of thing, right? With so, you know, this is sort of, you know, my plea for the funding agencies. Like every single gene you find like this, at least until, you know, a couple of years ago, that was a paper in, you know, very, you know, high-profile journal, right? So you can get these things very, very quickly when it works. But it doesn't always work. So here's an interesting example. Here's a region where there's a whole bunch of things that sort of seem significant here. Lots and lots of peaks. And if you look at the pattern of linkage equilibrium, they're actually not in LD with each other, but they're clearly clustered. Each of these little things here are genes, right? And this is the position in base pairs on chromosome 4. And I'll show you, so that's one thing we find. And this goes back to, someone had a question about the sort of clustering of things here. And I don't, this is flowering time as well. It's flowering time as well. And here is an even worse or better one. Here's, this is chromosome 5. Here's an example, it goes back to what you, here where you also have a whole bunch of peaks in a narrow region. But, you know, they actually, it appears, at least when you look at one of these sort of haplotype-based things, that it's actually a big region here, right? And if you see, this is 230,000, 260,000. This is 2,300,000 to 2,600,000. This is 300,000 base pairs, and each of these are gene models here, right? That in this case actually are in linkage equilibrium with each other, where you have sort of an elevated significance all over the place. I don't really know whether to trust it, but basically, so to make a long story short about this, so one of the really weird things we have found so far, or unexpected, is that we seem to recapitulate the linkage mapping results in that we find particular regions, often around known candidates, where there is a lot of associations. And depending on which particular phenotype we're looking at, the little peaks and SNPs kind of go up and down like this. Different things are significant. I don't actually know what's going on here. It could be complete nonsense, but I don't really believe that's the case. I mean, what it seems to indicate is that a lot of the classical, lots of the sort of published linkage mapping results are, you know, just needs to be looked at much more carefully. That it often is the case that if you look at these, that there are many, many linked genes that have sort of alleles going in the same direction. So that many of these quantitative trait loads that people have mapped actually consists of many, many linked genes that are very close together, right? Because even though this is a big region, right, 100 KB is not something you could ever tease apart with one of these crossing experiments, because you just don't have the power to do it, right?
So is there a reason why you're showing us the individual dots, mm-hmm, rather than some smoothed profile that they sort of
the averages? So this is a smoothing one here, right? Yeah, there is. Okay, so you've got to smooth them in an intelligent way then, because one of the things about one of the weird things about linkage disequilibrium is that if you study this sort of theoretically, what would happen with the sort of quiescent model and SNPs happening on it, right? Strong correlation means something. Weak correlation doesn't mean anything, right? So if you just took an average, or like, you know, put a spline through it or whatever, it would not be a smart thing to do, because it, you can easily show that just depending where mutations happen on a tree, right, you can get no association at all, no matter how close you are. So, you know, if you did that, this is sort of, the green thing here is an attempt to do that in sort of an intelligent manner, right? You basically, you build trees based on the local SNPs, like build tree topologies of all these things are related with respect to that point in the genome, right? And then you posit, okay, what if there is a mutation here? Could there be an unseen mutation somewhere on this tree that explains the phenotype, right? And that effectively is this moving thing, right? Because the trees, the trees capture the correlation between the SNPs, but do it in a, you know, genetically motivated way, right? But, you know, yeah, you could, people have come up with other things as well, but I worry that, you know, the majority of things are not going to be, so you'll kind of bias yourself towards, low values that way. I don't know.
The profile, the pattern of recombination rate, is it more like humans with off-spots, or it's more like humans?
No one knows. I'll show some data if we have the stomach to go through it. I have tons of slides here. There's no high resolution data. I mean, if you look at the linkage disequilibrium pattern, we clearly see evidence of hotspot, but I don't know what that means.
In cancer biology, when you do association with gene expression analysis, you find amplicons.
Yeah.
So it's as if the phenotype is not correlated to a SNP, mm-hmm. to a region on the chromosome.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you can do association studies not just with individual SNPs, but with amplicons. And if you would smooth it out somehow or change variables to regions in the genome rather than...
What do you mean there may be chromosome domains or something?
That get overexpressed, which have one gene or a few genes that it needs, yeah. So the rest of them are just going along the line.
Yeah. It's possible. I just don't know, right? I mean, there's clearly something going on that you get these clusterings, right? And many of these peaks are in known genes. Some of them are not, right?
And in some cases, you can even see pieces of DNA mm-hmm. that are detached from yep. the chromosome and
sure.
amplified. You see multiple copies of the same.
Sure. So, what's the longest case of gene regulation you see in humans? Or?
Hundreds of kilobases.
Right. So that's the scale we're looking here. Yeah. So look, I mean, I have a completely open mind about what's going on here. I mean, you know, one possibility is that, like sort of cis, as it were, gene regulation in Arabidopsis could go much further than we think. One should also remember that, you know, you talk about adaptation here, that's a clear possibility, right? I mean, you know, models of selection in some kind of spatially heterogeneous environment would actually predict that you kind of build up these blocks of linkage disequilibrium, where there be a bunch of genes that are adapted. You know, you could, you know, maybe it's the case that in this entire block here, there are some genes that are important for, you know, cold tolerance, right? Some are important for flowering time. And all this stuff together kind of builds up some kind of, you know, super gene, as it were, right? I mean, associated block.
One thing that surprised me a bit is that I haven't heard people really talk about to first divide the SNPs into a set that is for sure silent, like will not affect the protein coding,
mm-hmm.
and use this to understand the sort of population structure, and then look at the other guys in the context of what you can infer about the population structure from these things that are almost certainly neutral.
Right. Well, so, right. So first of all, so I wonder if I'll get to this in this talk, but I don't think there is anything in Arabidopsis that is almost certainly neutral. There's a big difference between the human genomes and the Arabidopsis genome. 50% of the Arabidopsis genome is genes, right? It's not like in humans where most of it is, you know, junk in quotes, right? This is it's a much denser genome. There is a lot of linkage disequilibrium, so there is absolutely no SNP that is not in linkage disequilibrium with SNPs that are in a gene, right?
But I mean, if you hit the third position of a four-fold degenerate codon, it mm-hmm. doesn't do anything. I mean, it maybe changes a little bit, you know.
Sure, maybe.
The translation.
Right, but it's still going to be in linkage disequilibrium with all the things that are next to it that are affected by selection, right? I mean, we have certainly looked. I mean, you know. Well, I can tell you, right? I mean, if you look at SNPs that are coding versus non-coding, right, there is a very tiny difference, and then see how correlated they are with some kind of inferred population structure. There is a small difference, but the patterns don't differ very much in aggregate across the genome. And I actually believe that that's probably true for humans as well. I mean, the only thing you can see for sure is that the slight tendency for non-synonymous substitutions to be less widely spread, right? And that's presumably because they're deleterious, right? So they tend to be focused more locally. But it's not the case that there's some part of the genome that is... So this is one of the things that I don't know if we clearly need to take some break at some point, right? If I get to the second part of this talk about selection for things, right? One of the things I become complete, you know, the standard framework somehow in inferring selection from, you know, molecular evolution model has been that, you know, there's this null of things that are not under selection. And that's being challenged by a number of people. And in Arabidopsis, I think I can show you some slides that, you know, will convince you that it's complete madness because, you know, you have correlation in polymorphism of large regions spanning, you know, megabases, right, going across genes and non-genes, right? There is no null model, right? It's all affected by selection and population structure. Mm-hmm. And this is the thing that, yeah, anyway.
We usually do take a break, and this might be a reasonable time where, you know better than other people. But it was something that, you know, right in the beginning when you were saying that we're quickly moving to this technology where mm-hmm. you sequence complete genomes and all these, you know, that we're going to analyze, it just does raise this interesting issue, and maybe it won't amount to anything, that when you do SNP association, you say, actually, I probably don't have a causative SNP in my data set, but I have one that's probably associated with the trait. Mm-hmm. Now you're going to have completely resequenced genomes to do the association, and all the causative SNPs are actually in your data set. You have the SNP there.
Yep.
And you have ones that are associated and linked, but not in it.
Yep.
But maybe it's just more of a philosophical difference than a practical difference, but it does raise this kind of interesting question.
I completely agree with it. And you know, let me just wrap up this bit very quickly. But you know, we were talking about ways of, you know, describing SNPs here. So you know, I just want to make this kind of confounding will be a problem, right? And what I mean by that is basically if you think about this kind of variation, I mean the kind of sort of association studies that I've been talking about now is clearly going to be the default, right? Because what used to be something that, you know, you need like human genetics resources and like, you know, Eric Landau to convince Congress to give money to get this thing done, right? It's going to turn into the default. Like doing experiments, growing things is always going to be very difficult, right? But for any of these problems, you want to find out the differences between, I think I put one of Scott Hodges, never mind the dogs. But, you know, here's one of Scott Hodges' pictures, like one of the, Scott's Aquilegia here, to put in a pretty picture of flowers in, rather than Arabidopsis, which is rather dull, right? You know, two species of California columbines, right? A hummingbird pollinated and a hawk moth pollinated, high mountain, very closely related species. You even find hybrids in nature, as you can see here, right? You want to find the genes that make these guys different from each other, right? So you can do all these crosses, you can do all this stuff, right? But look, we're quickly moving to a world where the first thing you do is like, well, you get 1,000 of these and 1,000 of these, and you sequence them all, right, and see if that works, right? And then you do something that actually requires thought, right? Yeah, because look, I mean, right? Because money, you know, well, I mean, you know, in the current stock market, maybe I shouldn't say that, but money is cheap and brain power is not on some level, right? And that, you know, that goes to, I was at a meeting recently talking about these African cichlids. You know, there's fantastic radiations in these lakes of things that also appear to be very closely related, perhaps interbreeding with each other. And it was me and Greg Gibson, right? And they were trying to get our advice on how to develop SNP resources and stuff like that. And we were both like, well, I think we think you're just wasting your time because in 2 or 3 years, you know, the obvious experiment here before you do anything else, right, is take, you know, 10, 20 of these guys, 10, 20 of these guys, and sequence their entire genomes, right, and just see if you can find the differences just by brute force, right? Now, the slides I've showed you up here suggest that there are some real challenges that it's going to be to interpret these data, what it actually means, right? But it's like, you know, people will, yeah, I'm going to get to the footprints of selection and select, I wanted to throw out one problem here, if someone knows the method. I need help with this, right? So there are all these methods for correcting for population structure. And, you know, I don't buy them because they tend to throw out the baby with the bathwater, right? And I think everyone understands what I mean by that. So there are also methods that, if you just wanted to analyze this whole... So essentially what we have, right? The problem is that you have a whole bunch of SNPs across the genome that can predict the phenotype, right? But they're redundant, right? Because they're actually in linkage equilibrium with each other. Okay, now there are lots of methods, like you can do like a stepwise regression, right? Or, you know, you can use some PCA method or whatever, where you like, okay, like pick out this SNP, right? That explains so much of the phenotypic variation, and but it also, you know, it's correlated with population structure, right? So the p-value is inflated and so on, right? You know, you can add that to the equation, then pick out another one, right? And you, whether you go by regression or PCA or whatever, you pick out another axis of variation. But that's not what we want, right? Because there are lots of methods that gives you kind of the best solution. Sometimes it gives you like the optimal solution for like explaining the phenotype when you have many explanatory variables that are, you know, there are too many of them and they're redundant, right? In the sense of being correlated. But I want a method that gives me a clustering of, you know, the possible explanation. So it's more like, okay, to explain the phenotype, go from the phenotype to genotype, we need one of these, you know, which is sort of a set, right? And then we need like one of these that belong to another set of things that are sort of, you can pick one of these, but it doesn't matter which one you pick, right? And then you could, you know, that's like in a simple set, but you can also imagine like, well, either you pick one of these or you pick one of these and one of these from two other bins, right? And, you know, this is related both to the population structure, but also analyzing, you know, epistatic interactions with multiple genes, right? It's a hard problem. You have like SNPs going to SNPs to phenotype, right? And you want to figure out different pathways of doing this. But you don't want to limit yourself to like, you know, finding the optimal anything, right? You want to find the whole cluster, because clearly then what you want to do is experimentally add other data to figure out, well, you know, within this set, which one is it, right? Or is it all of them, right? With some kind of small effect. You know, because you could imagine that being the case as well, right? So, you know, here we have mostly lots of correlations, genotype to phenotype. I think I can claim that, you know, there has to be at least one, you know, that is significant. But, you know, it could be all of them with some small effect. Yeah.
It seems that I'm certainly not going to give you an answer to that question, but there's a prior question to that question, which is, I think, so you show examples which are beautiful, Mendelian separation and very clear, and there's one genotype or one thing which is strongly correlated with your phenotype. And then you go to more complicated cases.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that when you switch to these more complicated cases, you are not distinguishing, I mean, you are mainly postulating two hypotheses. There is noise due to the structure of the population,
mm-hmm.
and there is a multi-locus genetic complexity.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first thing you to do maybe is try to find a way to tell where the complication comes from. Is it noise or is it genetic complexity? I think you don't answer this question at that point.
Actually, I think I do, because the, you know, if it's just multi-locus complexity, we know how that works, right? That would just reduce our power, right? Because what that means, that, you know, if you put this in sort of a simple kind of linear regression framework that we're using here, you know, that just means that every variable, because it either depends on or just, you know, it explains less of the variation, right? And you just, I had one slide where that, you know, remember the pathogen, you know, the fungal pathogen resistance thing. Really what should happen then is that you just lose significance, right? Because there's no single factor that explains enough of the variation, because it's a multi-locus scenario, right? And that's even if they're all sort of interacting additively on some scale, right? But if you, you know, but what we see here is like this massive inflation. Our problem is not that our problem is in some sense that we're finding too many things, right? It's not, yeah.
So maybe explain to me why it works very well in some cases and not in others.
Because, okay, two things, right? I mean, so we would get this confounding even, it's actually independent of the genetic architecture. What's going on is that the pathogen resistance is, you know, these simple examples, in addition to being very simple, right? But they are also under probably some kind of global balancing selection. So regardless whether you sample lines, you know, on some mountain in northern Sweden or you sample them close to the equator, you find both of these alleles. So they are in some sense segregating, you know, orthogonally to these axes of, you know, the population structure, right? So it's, you know, it's like you take the human example. If you took skin color, right, you know, all the Swedes are, you know, are not, you know, in a sort of 80 years ago world, all the Swedes would be white and all the Nigerians would be dark skin, right? But there's some traits, of course, like, you know, height, for instance, that would segregate within both these populations, right? And those we can find, right? So it's a question of whether you're looking at genetic variation across or within population structure. That's the main difference.
Okay.
And that differs from phenotypes to phenotypes.
But it seems that the issue is to distinguish the source of linkage disequilibrium, whether it's really population structure and then, reproductive isolation one way or the other, or it is some trace of selection, whether it's epistasis or some recent sweeps that picked up a large chunk of genome. So the most direct way of sort of empirically addressing this presumably would be some equivalent of sperm typing. So is there a way of doing that in the reproductive?
Oh yeah, that would be easy. Very easy to, sure, you can just grow F2s, right? Large numbers of them, right? And do, if you want to find recombination. But I don't think it's that simple, right? Because, you know, population structure, I mean, nothing I said here actually needs to have selection in it. If you just had population structure, you would have these sort of confounding effects, right?
I know, but you could have another hypothesis explaining.
Well, I think in some sense selection could help you tease this out, because I suspect in some cases that the amount of sort of structure you see here is sort of significantly stronger in some sense than the background, and that would give you more evidence that these actually are important in something that is adapted.
But again, all the traits have the same population structure.
Yep.
So the fact that four phenotypes that do not correlate with population structure, you can find nice results.
Yep.
Doesn't show, it shows that in the other cases, it cannot be all population.
Absolutely
structure,
right.
There must be some real things in there.
No, that doesn't follow. It doesn't follow. You can have population structure along, if you just take a map of isolation by distance, like just taking a sort of theoretical model, right? If you just had a, you know, sphere of isolation by distance, right? You know, if you have one phenotype, you know, being independent of that structure, right? You know, you basically, you know, on any sort of scale, you always find these things, whereas another one was correlated with, say, you know, latitude on this thing.
What Eric is
right?
saying is if it's really population structure, you expect that there'll be more than one phenotype that distinguishes the two populations.
And there is.
So then it becomes very interesting to sort of compare a bunch of phenotypes, and now if different phenotypes start systematically picking up linkage in the same blocks.
And we certainly find that. But of course the phenotypes are correlated, you know, too, right? I mean, the phenotypes are not independent because they're part of the same pathways, right? But yes.
So let's modify the statement. Orthogonal phenotypes.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I don't think we have.
For example, you know, eye color and height. Right?
Yeah.
Now, presumably, there's some systematic difference between Maasai's and Swedes.
Sure.
And these would be rather uncorrelated traits.
That's probably true, but both of them would
so
be. But that's right. But both of them would show confounding, right? But it still would be the case, right? I mean, you know, effectively, if these guys, you know, if it were the case that, you know, all members of this group were tall and all members of this were short and all members of these guys had blue eyes and all the guys had brown eyes, you know, the SNPs explaining this would be in LD with each other, even if they're in the different chromosomes, right? And so would a bunch of SNPs that just happened to have that pattern just by chance alone, right? So...
But anyway, I guess all that's being said is if it's really population structure, it should be identifiable, it should be pervasive.
It is pervasive,
so it
yes.
It should be identifiable just by looking at the correlation SNP distribution without associating it with any phenotype at all.
That's absolutely right. So that's in some sense the hope, right? That there's some kind of underlying process that affects the whole genome, and then you have these genes that are important to the phenotype. Now, of course, the real worry here is that the fraction of the genome that actually is involved in phenotypes starts approaching, but I don't think that's the case. I mean, so I think you're absolutely right. I mean, and for many, I think this is a particularly hard case, right? But, you know, I think, for instance, I'm told, like in Scots pine, for instance, right? You know, the amount of, if you just pick random markers, the amount of population structure you see is almost nothing, right? Because it's wind-pollinated trees, you know, the gametes flow very large distances. But yet it's the case that if you do sort of transplantation experiments, you know, over different latitudes, you know, it's basically fatal. I mean, the trees don't survive. So then it's a small number of the very small and well-defined parts of the genome that is under under strong selection. That doesn't seem to be the case here, right? And it's actually, it seems to be quite a bit messier than I thought, right? That you have these big regions. But clearly, I mean, look, I mean, if you go back to one of these, if you just go back to one of these genome-wide figures here. So, Right. Right. I mean, you know, it is not the entire genome, right? There are two things. There's clustering in the sense that there are particular regions here. But it's also the case that even, you know, if I zoom in on these things, I mean, you know, there are vast stretches in here that have no association at all, right? But it's devilishly difficult. I mean, you'd imagine that somehow you could pick out the outliers, right? That you can, you know, infer what the underlying distribution is. But that kind of goes back to that square root comment I made in the beginning, right? I mean, you'd kind of hope if you made a QQ plot of p-values that you still see, okay, you see this inflation factor, and then, whoom, here are these things that are clearly outliers, right? But it's not that easy. And I don't know exactly why that is yet, but,
yeah. So that line that you're showing is a Bontorin connection? Mm-hmm. What if you randomly split the population into two subtypes, mm-hmm. independent of phenotype, and said, what's the chance that I will see an association randomly? And that will give you a distribution of p-values, which is more believable than just a Bontorin correction, because that averages over all possible population structures, gives you a p-value distribution, and then the p-value is significant only if it is unusual in that distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And we've done this in looking for longevity markers in the Japanese and found that they're all due to population structure. There's no particular SNP in Japanese that predicts longevity that can translate to another population.
That's right. Yeah.
There's a standard, it's a paper by Widem and...
I have a feeling that we'd probably... Well, I think you can think about this in different ways, right? I mean...
That's just
a visual guideline, right? I mean, the point is that we are so far above those, right? I mean, so, you know, these associations are not due to chance, right? I mean, these are false positives because of a confounding factor, not false positives because of random noise.
Maybe it should be much higher.
Well, it depends on how you view it, right? I mean, you know, I know that these are false positives, right?
Let's take a break.
Okay. Okay, so I just, since there's been a bunch of people talking about selection here in the last couple of weeks, right? I mean, you know, I know you had Molly here, and you know, I thought I'd just say a little bit about that too. So this is just a sort of lead-in slide here, and this is going to be pretty short. But you know, so you know, our main focus has been on understanding the genotype to phenotype correlations, right? But we have all this polymorphism data. Of course, you want to try to learn something about, you know, the forces that govern it as well. And this is in a rather not as mature stage as the other analysis, right? So we have a big problem here. So, you know, sort of slightly provocative slide here, but one of the things that have, you know, have sort of really changed my view of things is looking at these Arabidopsis polymorphism data. Because I, as you know, as some of you know, I used to do a lot of population genetics modeling myself. You know, I did coalescent theory and this and the other, right? And it's sort of and it was sort of, there's always been this problem. I understand that you've heard a lot about, you know, the effects of population structure in screwing up these modeling aspects and so on over the last couple of weeks. At least that's what Sergei Nuzhdin told me, right? Now, when we analyzed these sequencing data that I told you about before, we had 1,500 loci in 96 individuals. You know, we made the observation that if we just look at properties like the variance in some statistic calculated on this locus across the genome, that was just too much variance to neatly fit into any kind of model. And we had this problem. We really were unable to fit any simple... So, you know, we know that these models are simple. You can add some population structure. You can add population expansion. You can do all these things, right? So you add that, and then you can fit the data a little bit better. But then you look at another summary statistic, and it still doesn't fit, right? So that was sort of the depressing message from that. But then when we started analyzing these Perl gene data, which basically adds the whole genome-wide feature to it, that's when I really started understanding the sort of width of the madness, of some sense, of where the field of molecular population genetics has gone to, which is these slides here. So what you see here, right? So these are figures from a paper in Science last year. We did just focus on the black line. So these are the five chromosomes. The black line here is the amount of synonymous polymorphism across the genome here, right? Now what's shocking about this, right, for people who were brought up doing molecular population genetics are the large scale fluctuations here, right? So if you go here on chromosome 1, for instance, right, if you just squint your eyes a bit, you see there's like a 5 megabase region here that has elevated polymorphism, right? And around the kind of vaguely green stuff here is the amount of repeats in the genome. This is sort of correlated with where the centromeres are. So you have a centromere here, 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 and here. And what you see is that there's a clear pattern on all chromosomes that around the centromere there is elevated polymorphism over a very large region, so that if you take it and sort of smooth it out, right, there's something weird going on. So this is deeply depressing because, you know, like I said before, you know, you can add population structure, you can add population growth, right? But as someone pointed out here earlier, that should affect the whole genome, right? There should be some kind of ergodic, whatever, property across the genome, right? So that was the idea that I was sort of brought up in thinking about molecular population genetics. Hey, we have some null model, which is most of the genome, which evolves neutrally. Then you have selection affecting some parts. You know, we're going to look for the outliers, right? But we got to get that null model right. And of course, lots of people didn't do that, and you know that was always sort of very distressing, right? But when you see here, it's like, you know, in what sense is there? What is the null model here, right? I mean, there's nothing. The genome-wide average doesn't really make any sense because there isn't a genome-wide average, right? I mean, there's clearly something. You know, chromosomal context has to be in that model as well, right? So what on earth is going on? And, you can sort of think about selection on linked sites. It's been correlated with recombination levels and so on. I'll show one more thing about that later. You could imagine somehow that there is duplicated genes, gene conversion between them. I don't really believe that. You could imagine, in this paper that we published, In 2007, we only had polymorphism data. You could imagine that there's like mutation rate differences here, right? So now we actually have an outgroup finally for Arabidopsis. The Arabidopsis lyrata genome has been sequenced, and we know that that's not the case, right? This is not due to mutation rate differences, at least not that you can measure between these two species. If so, the mutation rates must have changed very dramatically, very recently. I don't think there's any chance of that being the explanation. So this actually then must reflect sort of differences in genealogy, differences in dynamics within it.
Distribution in related species.
No data.
But in principle, do you think that would be a better way to do this?
It would be very interesting to see if you can find the same kind of patterns in closely related species as well.
Not same, but to have a null model, you take a whole bunch of related species and take the average polymorphism variance across the genome for them. After you match them up.
But how would that tell you? Well, I'm not sure what that would tell you, right? I mean, what you're trying to...
Evolution is what is driving this structure.
Sure.
And that it's just serendipitous, but certainly if you can find relationships which are related to the evolutionary pathway...
But this is not serendipitous in the sense that, you know, I should say, of course, that, you know, the reason this is shocking, I mean, this is not, it's not the case that linkage disequilibrium extends over megabases in Arabidopsis, right? Right, so I mean, you know, this... These are average properties, right? It's just that there's some spatial component across the genome to the average properties. I mean, there's certainly, you know, linkage disequilibrium in Arabidopsis extends over, you know, 5, 10 kb, right? So, you know, you have averaging here. This is not just flukes that there is a property. This is really what it is, right? I mean,
fluke in the sense that it doesn't matter for evolution, it doesn't care where in the genome you put a set of genes,
mm-hmm.
as long as some other higher order structure is maintained, which is not visible from this
thing. Right, but what would that higher order structure be? I mean, we're trying to understand the dynamics. I mean, selection acts on variation within the species, right?
Not in a neutral model. So I'm just suggesting a possible way to get the neutral model, which is to average over many species to find any association is probably preserved across related species in a phylogeny.
association between what and what?
Between let's say a fungal resistance to a fungus.
Yeah.
Many different species close to
Arabidopsis. Yeah.
Arabidopsis.
Yeah.
Would probably have the same phenotype associated with the same genotype.
Maybe, but we don't even have any phenotypes here. We're just trying to understand what explains the pattern of sequence variation.
This is anything but serendipitous. It could be completely serendipitous that the genome has many ways in which it can figure out what's going on in different regions of the chromosome, and it doesn't have to presume. It doesn't have to be simple so that we can figure out what it's doing.
Well, you're right. I mean, you need to define serendipity here, right? I mean, basically, it's
there's no content in the location of this set of valleys and hills.
Well, but there is. There is, right? I mean, it clearly is associated with the centromeres. I was going to say, too, there is a clear association here, for instance. These red clusters here tend to be genes that are involved in disease resistance. There appears to be a correlation between having gene family that's involved in disease resistance and having sort of high levels of polymorphism here. There is something going on here, right? It's very, very, very difficult to model it in some.
The black line is polymorphism at synonymous sites.
Yes.
And the purple is at intergenic sites.
Yep. And they're correlated. It's just that it's more inflated for the synonymous ones, and it's in 200 kb windows, 50 kb windows. I can't remember, something like that.
Where is the centromere?
It's the greenish. Here's one. Okay. It's there. It's there. It's there. And it's there. I'll show one figure of that later. It's not terribly nice. It's not very clean, like in Drosophila. Recombination is suppressed around the centromeres. Of course, recombination is suppressed inside the centromeres, right? But there's something else going on. Another problem here, which we have not completely addressed yet, is...
So
yes?
Do you have the pedigree of the 96?
There is no pedigree. There is linkage equilibrium extends over 5 kb, right? I mean, what's the pedigree of us in this room? Basically, any particular point, you're going to have a relationship between these lines. But, the tree related to these 96 lines changes every, 5,000 base pairs or even closer than that.
But the 96 individual that you have analyzed,
yeah,
has some pedigree that you have under control?
No pedigree. I mean, there are systematic differences in relatedness, just like, if you took everyone in this room, right? I mean, the people who have Chinese ancestry would be marginally closer related, right? I mean, so you have that kind of thing, but no, otherwise not.
Do the spectra of more or less putatively neutral polymorphisms look anything like they should look like?
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, there's negative Tajima's D, and, it depends on on the sample. I mean, the problem we had observed before is, like, when you looked at the detailed sequence data, is that the variance in all these statistics was much higher. I don't have any of those figures loaded here, right? But, I mean, on some level, I mean, you can't really, I mean, given that you have these spatial patterns, right, it's like there's something else going on. And one thing we did find, so cut to the chase here, here was an example of what we think, and I think still think, was a selective sweep. It's like a dip in polymorphism right here, very extreme. And if you zoom in on that region, you found that there was a... This is based on the Perlian resequence today. I should have said that, of course. You find out, so this is a plot where you show... Okay, so this is the red lines here. So this is the first accession compared to everyone else. This is the second accession compared to everyone except the first, and so on. This is the third accession compared to everyone except the other ones. And you draw dots here when there's basically some window of SNP sharing, identical SNPs, right? So regions of identity by descent. And what you see here is, like, for 18 out of the 20, there's a sort of pattern of identity here, right? And if you blow that up, it's a sort of bigger region. And it looks, kind of like there's been a selective sweep, sort of some allele that's been dragged through as everyone shares a region in that. And it made a very nice story, especially because the ones that did not have this, so the ones that are down here, one is in the Cape Verde Islands, the other one is in the very north of Sweden, right, sort of the outskirts of the population. So it looks pretty. But there are some worrisome features about this too. One of them is that, you know, the edge of this thing here is too clean. That's not how you'd expect the selective sweep to look like if there was a random recombination during the fixation of this thing. And you know, we're still trying to figure out exactly what's going on. One of the frustrating things is that these, you know, Perl gene resequencing data are very, very messy, right? Because they're based on hybridization to a reference genome, and you know, there are all kinds of sort of hidden biases in this, and tons and tons and tons of missing data. And we now have SNP data, but I'll get to in a second where I think there's more complications and all this. So here's like a genome-wide scan of these kind of sweeps in these data. But so what we just recently, if just for a couple of months now, we've had a reference genome finding. So one of the sort of really irritating thing about working on Arabidopsis has been that we had more polymorphism data in Arabidopsis than in any other organism except humans for the longest time, but no outgroup. Because, right, whereas, you know, there were like 12 Drosophila genomes, I think. Like the Drosophila people had the opposite problem, right? You know, lots and lots of comparative data, but no reasonable polymorphism data. And, you know, anyway, that's frustrating. But finally, you know, people are sort of sequencing the reference genomes here. So there's a couple of interesting things we learned from this. So here's Arabidopsis thaliana. Here's Lyrata. This one is considerably larger. And you can see perhaps that the flowers here are, you know, bigger. So this is an outcrosser. It actually sort of invites insects in, right? This one mostly cells. And these are separated by, what, something like 5-8 million years. This genome is 2 times larger than this. This one has 8 chromosomes, this one has 5, right? And then in addition to the mating system. So, and this, the ancestral state is having 8 chromosomes. So the reorganization of the genome has happened in Thaliana. And presumably it's related to the cell thing, but, you know, that's just a correlation. And so one of the things that have happened then is that you know, the chromosome number have changed, right? And if you go through how that has happened, there's been at least 5 inversions. So like big sort of chromosomal regions swapped around like this. There's been 2 reciprocal translocations, so chromosomes globbing onto other chromosomes, right? And then chromosomal fusions, right? And you know, this is supposed to illustrate, you know, so 5 million years between these and the next outgroup is 10 million years ago. So here, for instance, is how you, so this is the ancestral genome, you know, which it's, we assume that Lyrata hasn't changed very much from the ancestral, because basically in all closely related species, 8 is the number you find. So here's the ancestral karyotypes then. And this is the Thaliana genome. So you see here that chromosome 1, for instance, is a combination of this and this, red and yellow, right? And that's what these colors are supposed to do, right? These little things are inversions here. And if you look at chromosome 1 in particular, so what you have is this, right? So you basically, you have the ancestral chromosomes 1 and 2. The first thing that seems to happen is that this tip here underwent an inversion that put the centromere, which is this blob, is out at the end here, right? And then these two have been, you know, globbed together, and the bit has been lopped off, right? Okay, so, and there are stories like this, and, you know, this is, you know, we're puzzling together this in detail now that we have a reference genome.
Which one is the Celtic one, the one on the right?
Yeah, this is Thaliana, this is the one we were working on. So now, we're puzzling together in great detail what's happening here, but like, crudely, this is going on. Now, the interesting thing, so here's chromosome 1, right? If you now superimpose this pattern on what I showed you before, right, so here, yeah, this is one graduate student who sent me a figure with a whole bunch of things here, right? This is measurements of polymorphism, either in the light green, sort of correlated, corrected for the divergence between the species, right? So, you know, correcting for differences in mutation rate or not. And what you're supposed to see here, right, basically those values don't change, right? So the differences you see in polymorphism across chromosome 1 here with the inflated polymorphism around the centromere, here you can see better, this is the level of transposable element density and repeat density, right? So the centromere is right here. And, you know, you see here inflation polymorphism around both edges, and here's that big island of elevated polymorphism on chromosome 1. So this is not due to mutation rate differences. But if you now look at where this big blob of elevated polymorphism is, that neatly corresponds to that bit that was inverted in the slide I showed you before, you know, between, you know, during the origination of these new chromosomes. And in fact, if you look at some of these other elevated regions here, here's an inversion. So this is not changing chromosome here, but this whole region is inverted in the Arabidopsis genome compared to the ancestral state in Lyrata, right? And, oopsie. I think there was a... Yeah, on chromosome 5, you have similar things here. Here's like an elevation of polymorphism. And you see there's also, you know, these rearrangements in here. I mean, it's, once we started looking at this comparative data, it's pretty clear that the pattern of polymorphism that we see, you know, has to do with the chromosomal history, among other things. I'm sorry, running your way,
but I understand. So what you're inferring is that, maybe I'm missing your point, but is that you have a polymorphism which is associated with central mayors for non-reason, and you find that polymorphism is transposed to another region because of chromosomal rearrangement. That is a very rare event.
Let me see if I got this right.
So maybe I missed the point.
No, the point is that we have these large-scale patterns of polymorphism across the chromosomes, right? They are clearly correlated with the chromosomal rearrangement that has happened in the last 5 million years.
Yeah, and so how do you relate the two observations?
I don't know. That this is just the observation. I can give you some possible explanations of what's going on, right? But what it does tell you, right? I mean, it's clearly something that's been missing from understanding. If you want to go through this, like understanding the pattern of polymorphism with like simple coalescent models, right? So, you know, I was first arguing that, well, look, it doesn't make sense, right? You know, we always found too much variation when looked at single loci to, you know, to fit into any kind of population structure model or model with population growth or whatever, right? Then when you look at genome-wide pattern, you clear, well, that's obvious, right? There isn't a genome-wide pattern because clearly the chromosomal context also matters, right? And now we get some inclination. One way in which it matters is the history of the chromosomes. Now, how that actually happens, I don't actually know. I can think, you know, so it's well known that if you, for instance, have a segregating inversion, right? You have an inverted piece of chromosome, right? And somehow, you know, that suppresses recombination between the inversion heterozygous because basically the two bits can't match up properly, right? And you can sort of lock up balanced polymorphism in these things, right? And you can get more polymorphism this way. So, you know, one possibility that some of these things are actually not fixed, but that doesn't really work either because at least these big scale things are fixed as far as, you know, all Arabidopsis have 5 chromosomes, right? These major chromosomes. So there's some kind of residue here of the major chromosomal rearrangements that happened in these 5 million years.
Does it have to do with the inversion and not with the fusion?
Don't know.
Because could you test this with humans? Because humans and chimps have one chromosome difference and one of our chromosomes, the fusion of two of theirs.
So, and there's lots of data from, you know, should be from Drosophila too, right, for polymorphism. I have no idea what is causing
nobody,
it. Right?
Okay, nobody has checked
this. I don't know. Does anyone else know? Like if there's any pattern of,
So did you compare the pattern of polymorphisms for the inverted sequence to the mm-hmm. one that came from the, you know, from the related species?
Mm-hmm.
And how do those correlate if you compare that?
Say that again.
So you're saying this gene, I mean, this mm-hmm. segment here corresponds to a gene in the,
yep.
the reference species,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, has been inverted in
yep.
the and so
yep.
on. Now, if you compare the pattern of polymorphism
in the two species,
do they correlate?
So there is no polymorphism data from the outgroup species, so we have no idea.
Can you estimate how the time scale until the common ancestor of all your strains versus when this event happened?
Sure. So the amount of polymorphism in Arabidopsis would be coalescence times might be on the order of 1 million years, right? And these speciation is about 5 million years. So there's plenty of more, you know, almost all SNPs are fixed. Like, you know, there's no SNP sharing between the species, right? So it's a bit of a mystery, right? So we have the observation that clearly the pattern, large-scale pattern of polymorphism in Arabidopsis thaliana, you know, mirrors the rearrangements that happened since the speciation. And, right, I mean, so one possibility is that these inversions and rearrangements are still segregating, and I think I have a slide too, sorry. And this is just showing you again that basically peaks of polymorphism in thaliana mirror regions that have been inverted since the common ancestor that with Lyrata. If these inversions are still segregating, right? Because remember, this is comparing the Arabidopsis thaliana reference genome to Lyrata, right? Then you can imagine that they're basically balanced polymorphism maintaining variation in these inversions, right? That can't be always the case because, you know, the broadly the chromosomal, you know, some of these things are chromosomal level rearrangement, right? And you know, they are shared by all iridopsids as far as anyone knows, right? So some of the, so here's an example that it's not always the case, right? This is okay, this is a slide showing chromosome 5. Okay, here's the centromere. What these little arrows are is I'll take this one piece at a time. This is a line, so this is Arabidopsis thaliana, chromosome 5, right? And these colors indicate which part of which ancestral chromosome did they come from, and the organization in the ancestral genome of that piece, right? So basically it's saying that this entire arm came from the same ancestral chromosome or the same is homologous to the same chromosome in Lyrata, but there's been rearrangement here and rearrangement here. Incidentally, close to the centromere where you find all this elevated polymorphism. Here, well, I guess this is another of these chromosomes that's split up. So here are two different chromosomes, right? And again, there are lots of rearrangements here. This curve shows, I can't actually remember all the details, but basically this line is whether there's underrepresentation. So the Arabidopsis thaliana genome has also gotten smaller by half compared to the Arabidopsis thaliana is half as big as Lyrata. And as you can see, on average, this curve is below 1 here. This is basically the ratio on a log scale of the length, right, in some short windows. But you also see spikes. In some areas, stuff has been inserted, but on average, it's been lost, right? But there's a great deal of variance across the whole genome. And here, where someone asked about recombination data, here is an analysis of, I think, 19 F2 crosses. So each colored line here is an F2 cross, a recombination map basically. So you can see the landscape here. So there's less recombination here, a bit more recombination here, a little bit more right here. And here's an example. Here's clearly something that's segregating, right? So here there are two lines, or maybe I think it's supposed to be two, that have almost no recombination over this entire region here, right? And if you look at which there was a round-robin crossing design, so basically it's like one particular accession has been crossed in both of those. So that clearly has an inversion with the other one suppressing recombination across this entire region here. So let me see. This is kind of a very, this was very rough stuff I was going to tell you here, but basically, so try to sum up, right? So, you know, we went from sort of trying to model individual loci and, you know, learning that, well, we can't really fit any sort of standard population genetics model with demographics and inversions and stuff like that to it. Then when we look at genome-wide data, we see that that's obvious because there isn't such a pattern. There is no ergodic anything across the genome. The chromosomal context matters, right? Then when we started comparing with Lyrata, you learn that clearly it's like sort of hit you between the eye that this is correlated with the genome rearrangements that happened since the formation of Thaliana. So that observation is there. How exactly that happened, I don't know. And to understand what's going on, first of all, you really need to get a clear picture of how much of segregating stuff is still going on in terms of genome rearrangement. Right? And then the only way you can learn that is by sequencing all these independently at such a high level that you can assemble them independently. So that's one of the things we're trying to do, right? And the SNP data doesn't tell you that at all, right? I have all kinds of fantasies about how you might get this. I mean, so one scenario I came up with, you know, why would you get these enormously high levels of polymorphism in some regions for a rearrangement that's now been fixed? So one possibility is this, and for those of you guys who like to think about population and models, you can imagine, I mean, so how does this thing get fixed, right? Somehow there's a big rearrangement, and it has to spread through the entire Arabidopsis thaliana population. It suppresses recombination in a very large region, especially when there's like centromeres involved. Especially in the pericentromeric regions, you can easily see that will cause all kinds of chromosomal problems if there's crossing over there. Okay, as it goes through, you know, say that somewhere in the southern latitude this thing arises, right? It's selectively favored, perhaps because it carries genes involved in, you know, that does something better. Maybe there are better weeds, maybe there's better disease resistance, whatever. You know, as they go across multiple latitudes, they're going to be stopped, right? Because they run into genes that are selected for something else. So effectively, and you can imagine during these 5 million years, even though this thing is now fixed, there was balanced polymorphism for a long period of time. you know, basically holding this inversion in place, right? Because it, you know, unless all these things happen instantaneously, which I doubt, you know, these things have to fix, right? So you had balanced polymorphism, okay? Now, during that time, gene conversion can move chunks of chromosome back and forth, right? Between the inverted rearrangement, right? It's only crossing over that is suppressed because that causes all kinds of chromosomal difficulties, right? So that means that you effectively you can imagine that you can sort of elevate polymorphism locally, right? And so that when actually the thing finally sweeps, you could imagine. So there's a lot of parameters that work in the right manner. You can imagine that, you know, you still see the residue of this. It's like basically there were ancient population subdivision there. That has now been lost because now everyone eventually shares the fine polymorphism, but you still have the traces there. It's kind of the same thing. There was a talk about Neanderthals here yesterday. If you had, or sorry, last week, about if you had two populations that were separated in time, you know, they can swap genes back and forth. You can still see the traces of that, right? So,
yeah. It could be much simpler that evolution has two things that create diversity. One is recombination, one is mutation.
Yep.
And you have suppressed recombination. Selection has only mutations to deal with, and so. You know, the selection is driven now just by one thing, which is mutation, and that overtakes recombination.
Right, but remember the outgroup data, though. These polymorphisms are only seen as polymorphisms, right? There's no difference in the amount of synonymous substitution between the species.
Well, so the entire diversity that is required to accept that huge chromosomal rearrangement that you imposed on the species is now all selected for by polymorphism rather than by recombination. And so you...
So, right, but it's hard to see that that would not give rise to an accelerated rate of divergence, right? If you're saying that mutation rate goes up like that, you'd see...
No, mutation rate doesn't go up. Selection is driven by mutation alone.
And substitution rate goes up.
Substitution rate. Yes, right. But then you would see it as an elevated KS, right? Right? I mean, you know, no, you don't, right? That's almost flat, right? What you see is like highly, you know, these big blobs of elevated polymorphism are only...
These are neutral.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I'm sure they're not neutral, right? But it's in the coalescent, right? I mean, what you're saying is that the mutation rates are not, as we can tell, different. But what's going on is that there's just deeper genealogical relationships in some regions and in some other regions, right? So that's population genetics. It's not... Yeah. But yeah, that's mystery. And you know, so superimposed on this, I mean, you had some talk about right. So here's, you know, we also see this sort of thing that's been seen in many organisms. Like if you look at the recombination rate and the nucleotide diversity, there is a correlation. And if you estimate that, because the previous one was based on map-based estimate, if you do it based on linkage equilibrium, you have an either stronger one here, right? And that appears to maybe go on a different scale as well, right? So. Anyway, I just wanted to if the previous section was messy, this is even messier, right? And basically, part of the reason it's sort of unfinished is that I've almost sworn an oath that I'm never going to analyze any data like this until I have complete genome sequences, independently assembled of everyone involved, right? Because there's, you know, well, I mean, yeah, it's right. There's just so much uncertainty. It's just nerve-wracking to try to make sense of something if you don't know. You know, what's actually going on a fine scale here. And I think we'll very soon get some insight into, you know, how right or wrong I am. But I just suspect that there's going to be a fantastic amount of, I mean, that basically the processes that led to the shrinking of the genome are still going on. And you know, that shapes the pattern.
So, you know, there are species with a smaller genome who are beginning to have this kind of data. Did you, in fungi, for example? Still don't have the data?
No. This is Perl gene data set we've been analyzing here. I mean, there's really, I mean, Arabidopsis next to humans has more polymorphism data than any other organism by long shot. I mean, this is going to change very rapidly with these new sequencing technologies, right? But, you know, it's still a long way, still a long way to go. So, leave you with that, right? But this kind of also explains why, you know, I don't really... Here's a case where, you know, if there is a neutral model to be had here to use as a backdrop, like, I have no idea what it is, right? Because it, you know, it clearly needs, in addition to... I mean, in addition to modeling, you know, population structure and stuff like that, it also has to model chromosomal context in the right way, right? Because that obviously has been a major factor in governing the pattern of polymorphism. And once you get these kind of blocks and you have selection and stuff like that in it as well, it's not clear to me that it's a meaningful exercise at all to try to identify, you know, a background model, right?
If you had complete sequences, you wouldn't need a neutral model.
No. I mean, if you try to understand the process of evolution, right? I mean,
if you have sufficiently divergent clusters, then you don't need a neutral model. You just compare the two.
Well, it depends on what the question is, right? If you understand dynamics of this, right? I mean, the idea is somehow you can, you know, the idea with the neutral model is that you have you're trying to see selection as different from whatever else is going on, right?
It's like the ether in physics, it may not exist.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
No, but wait, sorry. But I mean, it is quite plausible that a lot of the mutations that occur will not significantly affect fitness. I don't think there's
any
problem with assuming that a lot of mutations will not do much.
Totally agree. Right.
And so, and they will also then be a substantial amount of variation that you're going to see. It is just that the variation that you see is always linked to things that do matter to selection.
Yep.
It's very hard to disentangle these things.
That
doesn't mean that there is no neutral variation.
No, absolutely. I have no problem with that, right? I mean, surely, right? But the problem is this, right? The problem is that you see these kind of, right? Exactly, right? I mean, even, right? It's the amount of synonymous substitution here, you know, clearly varies in some non-random way across the genome, right?
And there's some organisms where there's maybe no neutral variation. I mean, we heard all these talks about Drosophila, you know, where they look across non-coding regions and, you know, the rate of evolution is suppressed by 50%. And, you know, what does involve...
Yeah, I mean, okay, so you're saying every single site you can hit in the genome has an effect on selection that's bigger than 1 over n. I find that very hard to believe, right?
Well, you know, we're always talking about, like, the first approximation. Tell me how any mutation in E. coli could get to any appreciable frequency where you see it in a sample. Drifted, you know, to that kind of frequency. But E. coli isolations tend to be 18th or something. E. coli is the extreme case, where it seems to be somehow in between. That it's just. Well, one of the things that's going to be very interesting is, and maybe this goes back to where I started, mm-hmm. but it's interesting to bring in these different organisms and you get different perspectives on things. And perhaps Magnon even knows more than me about this, but it doesn't look so bad in Drosophila as this,
right.
In certain respects.
Even in E. coli, we can take these regions that are downstream of autologous genes, and then you make alignments, and half of the sites are different. Am I supposed to assume that all of them really affect, if I take an E. coli and a Salmonella and at this sort of distance?
I'm comfortable with that idea.
That all of these have a significant effect on selection. I mean, then most of them are going to have hitchhiked along with things that have effect mm-hmm. of selection, right?
Well, again, you know, it's also just like Kimura's neutral theory. He wasn't proposing that every single mutation is, you know, selectively neutral. It's just preponderance of them are. And perhaps in organisms like even Drosophila, but E. coli, you can flip that and the preponderance of the segregating variations, especially somebody that gets a frequency to see it. I don't know. I've become, maybe in some ways like Magnus, much more agnostic about, you know.
Yeah.
Sorry, I don't really understand that argument at all, because let's assume that there is something that hits a gene that is very important and starts sweeping. Now that particular version of the gene may have some silent changes at third position, and they will sweep along, and
yeah.
they're neutral, right?
I sure.
mean, they have no influence on the selection, which is all on this associated site nearby, right?
Right.
But not all third yeah. position changes are neutral. Not necessarily. I mean, I don't even mean, even if they don't change the amino acid, they're still not neutral, because they affect transcription rates, they affect translation rates, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but what I'm saying is those numbers may be very small compared to things that happen nearby that really affect the coding sequence and really affect what this gene does, or its efficiency in whatever it does, right? I mean, and then for all practical purposes, the effect on fitness of those are then neutral.
Well, somehow my understanding of this natural neutrality remark was not so much the statement that, that there is there are neutral mutations, but it's the death of neutral theory as theory of observed variation.
Right.
Which is a different issue.
Again, yeah. Yes. Wait, so it's not the death of neutrality; it's the death of uncorrelated.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes.
I think that's pretty clear, at least for Arabidopsis. Yeah. That it's.
I guess that there is also one twist to this thing, that when it's really so strongly correlated that everything is dominated by sweeps, then there may be even a matter of definition what we mean by neutrality, because then we have all these sort of weaker selected mutations that are just swept around, although they have their own selection coefficient which is sort of below the threshold which dominates the thing, then it may be a matter of nomenclature whether we call them neutral or not, because they're not behaving according to their own selection coefficient, although they have one, which under independent sites would have counted as non-neutral.
Sure.
And so, to some extent, it requires probably a more exact redefinition of what we mean by neutrality.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I have a little less philosophical question. How does the level of variation in Arabidopsis compare to C. elegans, right? So both are selfing. C. elegans, I think, is
it's much higher.
5% heterozygosity.
How much is it?
I think it's 1.5%
in C. elegans.
No, it's less than that, I think.
No. It's a tenth that.
I'm sorry, but
it's a tenth that. It's quite low.
So one tenth of that.
Yeah. Yeah. One tenth of human.
Yeah.
Okay. But again, which is bizarre.
What is it here?
It's about the same. I mean, maybe half as much as in Drosophila, so it's much more than in humans, 0.5%.
There's more in Arabidopsis than there is by quite a bit.
I guess my the number is that's male. There's 1.5% of male.
Right.
Yeah, no, this, I mean, the selfing part doesn't actually, that actually is not really predicted to change polymorphism that much. It just makes it behave more haploid, it's kind of funny, right? Because if you look at much of it, it actually looks like a haploid organism with a somewhat lower recombination rate than Drosophila. I mean, actually, the scale of linkage equilibrium in general is about the same as in humans, which has a smaller effective population size, by a good chunk, right? So.
So if I look at the black line there,
yep.
I imagine that I see localized peaks of diversity rather than localized dips.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you pointed to a dip earlier on and said this was a sweep that mm-hmm. was reducing diversity.
Yep.
But maybe this is just my imagination, but I imagine I see localized increases in diversity.
Yeah.
Is there a process that causes that?
So first of all, it's a question, what is the baseline here? Is anything, and does it even make sense to make that statement? So when I first saw this and noticed that with these R genes here, I was thinking, well, it has to be some kind of balanced polymorphism, right? But then we noticed that, in addition, this entire region corresponds to an inversion, that's presumably been fixed since the emergence of, Dirata, right? Not fixed, but this one I think is, right? Because this one is an inversion that preceded, presumably, the chromosomal fusion between these two neurons, that thing. So that one I think is fixed, right? And it's, so I think some kind of balancing selection, basically keeping these two two competing haplotypes around for a long time, sort of, and then sort of the polymorphism being shared with gene conversion is the only thing I can think of, right? But I'm, like I said, I mean, I am so nervous about, I really, really want to see the complete sequence of a couple of these things before I get, you know, too much into this, because it's also like, I mean, you know, the quality of the data is dubious, right? I mean, it's devilishly hard when you have, you know, you see there's also an increase of repeat frequencies and stuff like that here, right? And I, you know, I believe that the data is correct and it seems to be correlated with whatever accurate sequencing data we have, right? But, you know, it's like, it's kind of funny, right? It's like, I keep doing, you know, this to myself, right? You know, you know, the fact that we went through this and didn't even consider, you know, what clearly was to be a major feature, right? And in 5 million years, the genome size has shrunk by, you know, almost a half, and you lost 3 chromosomes, right? You know, that, it's like, but that sort of tells you sort of, you know, your training. It's like, you know, this is actually a big deal. I mean, you know, on some level, we're used to thinking as population genesis as if chromosomes didn't matter, but they do, right? I mean, it's pretty obvious. So
it's kind of curious that the intergenic shows much less of these pronounced peaks.
Yeah. Well, there's much. Well, actually, part of that's curious on many levels. For one reason is just the scale, actually, because there's actually much less polymorphism in intergenic DNA than there is in synonymous. I don't think I have a slide of that here, but if you look at the frequency spectrum at different sites, the only thing that, you know, the thing that looks most neutral in the sense of being less skewed towards rare alleles and stuff like that is the synonymous ones. Like the intergenic ones are much more strongly selected than the synonymous ones. So, which is, yeah, for whatever that's worth, and certainly the introns as well appear to be under. So there's much less polymorphism there. You know, again, you know, taking the biases, you know, we shouldn't fall into this sort of human trap here. When I say that, I mean the parts of the intergenic DNA that you can actually align, right? In when you do this is hybridization based, where you actually have data, right? Because clearly there's lots of regions that are highly, highly polymorphic in which we have no data for whatsoever.
But so you had a hypothesis that when this chromosomal piece was inverted, that mm-hmm. you basically couldn't get interbreeding between the segregating subpopulations that mm-hmm. had this inverted. And
that's right.
That would also affect the local intergenic in the same way.
Yep. Yeah, so that's why you get a correlated increase, right? But, you know, there are other processes working as well, right? Right? So that's why you get an increase in everything in that region, right? But, you know, the data is a little bit too, so I guess my working hypothesis, right, is that if we actually go in, when we have complete sequences, what we'll see is that really in these regions, it's not the case that polymorphism is overall higher. What we're going to see is that you're actually going to see this pattern of, you know, a very patchy pattern where you like have, you know, 5-6% sequence divergence in a short stretch, right? And then it goes back to much lower and stuff like that. And that will correspond to sort of effectively ancient gene conversion events. I mean, it actually explains when we tried really hard. Some smart people tried hard in my lab to fit population genetics models to the data we had earlier, sequence data. And it always looked like there was like basically introgression, like some kind of ancient, you know, if you paid attention to this Neanderthal talk that was a couple of weeks ago, it somehow appeared that there had been sort of, you know, integration from a very small population that was highly diverged somehow, right? And sort of what I'm thinking that might actually be, right, is, you know, residues of, you know, different genome rearrangement that existed and were sort of, you know, existed and were around for a long time during the, you know, these last 5 million years. You know, perhaps, I mean, you can even imagine, like, you know, Arabidopsis lyrata, I mean, the ancestral species could have been much more widely spread and adapted to a whole bunch of different habitats, right? And then sort of somehow, you know, the selfing thing comes up, right? And it spreads through the species. And, you know, I mean, this is like one of those things that I think population theory hasn't really thought through very well. I mean, how does this kind of speciation actually happen, right? I mean, you have, you know, a new species that partly, you know, crosses and you know, how does it actually evolve, right? It's just, I don't think that was a single event. I mean, that turned this into a new species. I mean, it gradually became more and more self-fertilizing, right? And there were probably different, you know, a bunch of different loci involved, and they swept through. And in addition to the usual things of gene sweeping through, it was also associated with genome rearrangement that must have swept through. And these things kind of went in episodes, and it's just very complicated, then, right?
So is there a number on the frequency of outcrossing?
It's about, I mean, you know, on the order of 1 in 100. I mean, if you go out and genotype individuals, you know, you find heterozygotes at about 1 in 100 frequency. And that's, you know, that's actually, if you crank through the math on that one, you know, that's, you know, little sex goes a long way, right? That actually breaks up the linguistic equilibrium pretty effectively. And then, you know, I suspect, we don't know how to demonstrate that either, that it's probably the case that these outcrossers are, they're offspring of outcrossing events will often be selectively favored because they're going to mask various recessive mutations and stuff like that. So
is it also possible? I think you probably talked about it, but high recombination rate in locally in those regions?
In these regions here? Well, let me show you that this is the kind of data we have, right? I mean, you can, we also have estimates, you know, population genetics estimates of, based on linkage equilibrium, right? But that's sort of, whoops. That's completely confounded, right? So here are direct estimates of recombination rates, and for what it's worth. You know, there's a great deal of heterogeneity here. Don't pay too much attention to some of these peaks, right? Because that's just small distances and rare recombination rates that blow this up, you know, marker distances. But, you know, the broad patterns seem to be something like this, right, with a couple of clear outliers. But, you know, still this is, yeah, so this is a megabasis here, right? I mean, the resolution of this thing is not enough to get into, yeah, I'll explain the details, right? Yeah, but like, right, I mean, so recombination hotspots and stuff like that, it's always been a sort of a mystery to me. When people talk about this, they always talk about their hotspots in the human genome, right? I mean, the recombination frequency is a property of two genomes, the ones that happen to be together, right? I mean, those are the ones that recombine, right? And I don't see any reason, you know, to believe that recombination, you know, I mean, you can't, you know, you could imagine that this is shared across every pair, right? But you know, certainly when you start invoking inversions and things like that, and micro-rearrangements, and I suspect that we're going to find in human data as well that a lot of these so-called hotspots actually correspond to things that have been inverted, right? And, you know, then, like, the hotspot is a property of two genomes, right? And basically the genotype has those two things, and it's not the sequence motif at all, right? But
well, at least in fungi that I know better than humans. Mm-hmm. In terms of genome, hotspots do exist.
No. They do exist. Right? But you know, one thing you can do it, right? I mean, if you have a rearrangement, right? Like this, when you measure in SNP data, right? As people do. I mean, so clearly, there are well documented cases. I'm not disputing that, right? But in SNP data, you know, when people go and estimate hotspot recombination, right? If what you would have is that basically these two SNPs that you think are actually sitting 1 kb apart. Or actually 10 kb apart, right? I mean, that's the hotspot of recombination right there, right? If they are 10 kb apart in, you know, 50% of the matings, right? And you get a much increased frequency of recombination. All right, I think I thoroughly exhausted everyone.
You're hanging out in my office?
Yeah.